To Hartford's Literary Podcast. I'm Emma Smith. I teach English at Hartford, and I'm really delighted that my guest today is James Hawes, a prolific writer, novelist, historian, teacher of creative writing, and Hartfordian. And I hope we're going to talk about all of those elements of James's career as well as his memories of Hartford. Can we start there, James? Hello, welcome.
Good morning, Emma. Thanks very much for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Tell us a bit about you and Hartford. You read German, didn't you?
I did. I mean, I'm one of those people who was tremendously lucky in that I benefited from the Tanner scheme. I went to a state school, a very, what would nowadays be called offensively a bog standard comprehensive, I suspect, a very rural Shropshire comprehensive, which had no tradition really of sending anyone to Oxford. One of my friends had got into Corpus the year before, and my history teacher, whose name, unforgivably, I forget, had been to Hartford and said I should apply. And I did, and got one of those wonderful offers of a place with only two E's, which I remember going straight to the pub in my small Shropshire town, which, of course, this being the 70s, you could go to in your school uniform, and celebrating with my various friends, most of whom are farm labourers and things. So it completely changed my life coming here, and the Tanner scheme was it. And I suspect that, you know, whenever I hear today people objecting to the notion of special schemes for entrance from various groups, I have to put my hand up and say, well, you know, in my day, I was one of them.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And what was Hartford like when you arrived? Was it as you expected? Did you feel at home? How was that transition?
I felt wonderfully at home because thanks to that wonderful Tanner offer, I had that sense that I came back once in my during my upper sixth year to visit the place, knowing I was going to go there, and so I was able to allow myself to completely fall in love with the place in a way which an ordinary interview candidate doesn't dare do in case they fail, and knowing I was going to go there for sure because I wasn't not going to get two E's, obviously. So I came sort of all prepped up and already half in love with the place, really, when I came here. And it absolutely fulfilled my sort of Oxford dream, and in a very good way, because I think what made Hartford special then, and as far as I know still does now, is that it seems to me to mix the very best of Oxford without some of the less good. It is a place full of, you know, it has its own traditions, its own wonderful buildings, which have become an icon for the whole university in the case of the bridge and so forth. But it didn't, and I don't think it does, have all that sort of blooming Brideshead Revisited and the Zuleika Dobson thing, which frankly is neither old nor truly traditional. You know, things like the Piers Gaveston Society were only invented in the 60s, for God's sake. And people who get so entranced by all that sort of thing and think that's the real Oxford are falling for, you know, something invented by very self-consciously by literary people like Evelyn Waugh in the 20th century, essentially. And Hartford was thankfully free of almost all of that, which I think made it the perfect balance.
We were all very amused when the latest film version of Brideshead was filmed in Oxford. And of course, Hartford didn't look Hartford enough to be Hartford. And those scenes were all shot in Jesus College. So it is interesting that we've got Evelyn Waugh as one of our, if we were doing a Hartford Literary Podcast back in the day, I would be hoping to get Evelyn Waugh, though I'd be terribly frightened, I think, to discuss with him.
Well, I mean, as a writer, I absolutely adore him, I have to say, you know, just as a literary stylist. I think he's one of the very few novelists of the 20th century who I reread for sheer pleasure. And I use Decline and Fall in my creative writing classes to this day. So because the setup, which we, of course, know is in Hartford, is just an absolute masterpiece of a creation, a brief, wonderfully economic creation of a world. So I adore Waugh as a writer. Whether one would have liked him as a person is another matter entirely.
Absolutely. And did you think of yourself as a writer? Did you want to be a writer when you were at Hartford?
I did, actually, but this is one of the interesting things. It's something, actually, I've been vaguely talking and hoping to get something going with our new principal, Tom, about this, is that what I suffered from was because I had absolutely no literary connections of any kind. I mean, you know, I went to a school where the height of culture was an annual trip to the Birmingham Rep. And when I came up to Oxford, I did want to be a writer. I had tried writing mad things like a five-act blank verse drama in the sixth form. But I realised that some of the people, and even in Hertford, some of the people, but in other colleges more so, there were young people of my age who'd had debentures to the Royal Court and had grown up with publishers. I remember being very jealous of Will Self because he had a girlfriend from Hertford who I was hopelessly in love with. But of course, you know, Will had an entirely different background. For him, having dinner with publishers and things was just something he'd done all through his youth. And I was very, very struck straight away and a bit thrown back, I have to say, by realizing that I, coming from rural Shropshire and a comprehensive as a would-be writer, found myself completely out of my depth when I joined little writing circles and things at Oxford. Not at Harvard, but at Oxford generally. Because one realized the enormous gap of just a knowledge of the way things work or of who you know. And one of the things I think that's something which I would love to do if I had any role to play in trying to get things going for Harvard students in the future. My son went to Christchurch and they have a fantastic program of alumni only internships, absolutely open. No beating about the bush. And I was talking to Principal Tom about this, saying, with the support of a fellow Hartfordian contemporary of mine, who's now very big in industry, whether we ought not to do the same here. Because one of the things that people who aren't Oxfordians misunderstand is they seem to think that by virtue of coming here, you are immediately an insider of the big world. Anyone who's been to Oxford knows that's not the case, and that some people come with ready-made friends and contacts and so forth. Others don't. And I think it would be a natural extension of Hartford's unique tone to try really hard to persuade, you know, alumni who've made it and have got successful to make a special bid to help out our current alumni who, when they leave Oxford, will find themselves, as I did, still without those contacts and get-ins to publishers and agents and things like that. I really, because even when I left, I still really had no idea how to go about these things at all.
I think that's such a good idea, and it would, I think, help. I mean, it would help all kinds of students, but it would do something which is really close to my heart, which is maintaining the humanities as degree subjects, which are really open to a diverse range of students. We're all worried that in the age of fees and, you know, all these kinds of things, that the humanities look decorative or indulgent rather than a proper training for all kinds of professional roles. And I think that would be fantastic to see that.
I would love to see a sort of concerted effort by people in the humanities. It's something I've been talking to some colleagues about already elsewhere, to really sit down with people in the non-humanities, or certainly in the social sciences, for example, and point out the enormous benefits to people that accrue from being, you know, literate, from being commanders of language. You know, one only has to look at the enormous success of popular science, for example, to think that one really ought to be able to whet the appetite of everyone in Oxford working in science to train themselves in, for want of a better word, rhetoric. Storytelling, because what the hell has Yuval Noah Harari done, for Christ's sake? You know, what did Jared Diamond do? And though these people are scientists who've absolutely made their names by telling a story of their work, which they would not be able to do were they not also, you know, in the humanities sense, cultured literary people.
Yeah, I really agree with you, and I think one of the things in my subject in English literature that we sort of did wrongly. It was intellectually an interesting experiment, but and I suppose this was all the kind of, is there poetry after Auschwitz and that kind of movement in the second half of the 20th century? Can literature make you a better person? Of course, there were terrible people who did terrible things who were very literary, and we sort of lost confidence in the humane aspects of the humanities. And I do think we probably need to come back to that a bit.
No, I absolutely agree, Emma. And I mean, I go further than you. I take the sort of freedom of being a non-professional to go further than that, and say that I think that loss of confidence in what you rightly said called the humane angle of humanities led to this, I think, generational dead end of excessive theorizing, which I think is largely responsible for the fact that, bizarrely, one might think, as recruitment in English is under threat in many places, recruitment in creative writing is soaring, because essentially creative writing is in many ways simply doing what English did before the so-called theory boom. And I think that's I think that is largely at fault for the collapse of recruitment. I believe students do not want to be theorized at. I'm speaking as someone who was absolutely forced, and I mean literally obliged, to read Derrida for my PhD. I was told in 1988, you cannot write a PhD about Kafka and Nietzsche without a chapter on Derrida. I said, I don't want to read him because I think he's useless. And he said, sorry, you've got to go away for a year. I found that outrageous then. I find it outrageous now. So I wrote an entire introduction as an attack on deconstruction, which I'm very glad to say was very well reviewed. I think that if we abandon this really ridiculous attempt to science-ize the humanities and re-find our mojo and our confidence as teachers of humanities, of what you rightly call the humane humanities, I love that, then I think we'll be able to approach other disciplines and say, you know, we're not trying to ape you. We're not trying to persuade ourselves that Saussure is a scientist, for God's sake, or something like that. We are offering something completely different, which is of great value to you and your students.
The pandemic has been instructive, I think, in that who would have thought that people would, you know, want to watch, I don't know, Patrick Stewart delivering a Shakespearean sonnet every day on social media, or, you know, retreat into reading. The growth in reading. I was just thinking about a colleague of mine who was the head of medical sciences here at Oxford, Alistair Buchan. And we would go to university council meetings together where, you know, millions and millions of grant money would be allocated to medical sciences for research into cancer and so on. And he and I would talk afterwards, and he would say, you know, well, our job is to prolong life, and your job is to, you know, make it clear why that's a good thing. You know, and that was a very good and kind of generous idea. But I've thought about that quite a lot during the pandemic, when we've been so focused on Oxford science and the wonderful work of the vaccine, but also thinking a little bit about, you know, what does the humanities give to that? But let's move to your stuff, because you've been an amazingly inventive and prolific writer. I think the first thing of yours I read before I knew that you were connected to Hartford was White Murk with Fins. And I've got here in front of me The Shortest History of England, which came out last year. How would you describe the shape of your writing career?
Well, I think it started off simply by imitating writers I loved. And that's something I always recommend to my students, is to not only not be ashamed of the idea that you're imitating, but to absolutely embrace it. I simply give them a couple of examples. You know, look at Samuel Beckett, who was literally carrying James Joyce's bags for years. If you look at, I sometimes start off with the first paragraph of The Corrections by Jonathan Franzen, and take them through it and show that you can, on an almost clause-by-clause level, it's a rewrite of the beginning of Bleak House. And I started off, I was absolutely mortally in love with the works of Franz Kafka as a student at Oxford. I had this extraordinary experience where Sir Malcolm Paisley actually let me very briefly hold, the original manuscript of The Castle, which would never be allowed these days, of course, not even for 2 minutes, and showed me a wonderful part of where Kafka's writing changes within the text, but in the original, in Kafka's handwriting. So I copied him for years and years until I finally sort of, I suppose, as they would put it, you know, found my own voice in conversation with one of my students at Sheffield University. He just said one sentence, and I realised, my search is over. I found a voice at last, you know. But it's a long thing, but it all starts off with assiduous copying until you can learn the craft, you know. And once you've got the craft, and I'm a firm believer then that you can apply
I won't say the rules, but the templates of writing to anything really, whether it be screenwriting or writing as I am now, what I would call creative nonfiction. It all works in the same way. A story is a story is a story, and it all needs, you know, whether you're writing the story of the Sea Salt Company and its foundation as a chain of shops, or whether you're Yuval Noah Harari writing the history of humanity, or Philip Pullman starting a story, you find if you look at them closely, they're all doing exactly the same thing, essentially. And so I'm just eternally fascinated by the way that, you know, I say, without trying to pretend they are rules, they are nevertheless paradigms which work for almost everything, and which every student, whether of creative writing or simply of being literate, really should be aware of.
That's so striking, because one of the questions I wanted to ask you about was, you know, how you saw the differences between the fiction, your adaptation of your own novels for cinema, powerfully, brilliantly successful short history of Germany and then of England. But what you're saying is that fundamentally, these are all about storytelling, and storytelling is your craft.
Yes, it's a craft, and even more so, it's a craft, and I mean it almost literally like a medieval guild craft, in that it's also collaborative. You know, I didn't invent the notion of the shortest histories. I was approached by a publisher who is also a very good editor. He was at Univ, and he said, would I like to write the second one? He'd published one already, The Shortest History of Europe, which had done very well. Would I like to write it for nothing, basically? And I was so taken by him, by the idea, that I said yes. I'm very glad I did. But it was thoroughly collaborative. I mean, in the same way we now know that Raymond Carver's style was essentially his editor's style, not Raymond Carver's at all. So you know, what I write is really genuinely collaborative. I mean, and it is my proud boast that if I'm writing something for, whether it's a book or a big article for Prospect magazine or something, I tell the editors, you know, I really mean this. You're right. If you don't like something, take it out. And I know that when I was writing Random House, my editor used to be astonished. And I'd say, well, just take, if you don't like that paragraph, take it out. He'd say, what, really? You don't mind? And I'd say, well, no. If you don't like it and my agent doesn't like it, you're right and I'm wrong, the pair of you. So go take it out.
Has that been hard work to sort of step, you know, sort of, as it were, killing your darlings, to taking the ego out of it? Or does that come quite easily to you?
It doesn't come naturally. It comes in my case, it came with the recognition of disaster, because I didn't do that. When my second novel came out and was immediately optioned for a film, and I was allowed to write the film and co-produce it, you know, I thought to myself, here I am, I'm 37 years old, I'm a sort of, you know, sexy, hot, young novelist. I can do anything. Who needs to read Robert McKee? That sort of thing, you know. And the fact was, I hadn't the first notion how to write a screenplay. I had not mastered that craft at all. The result was absolute disaster. You know, I think Halliwell Film Guide describes that film, I don't even name it, I call it the Russian film in the sense of the Scottish play, the worst film ever made in the UK, and that's against some pretty tough opposition. It was a complete disaster, and it could have ended my career then and there. It almost ended the director's career. But I took a step back for it and realised I really need to wake up here and understand that I am not always right, because my inverted commas feelings are not a reliable guide to what works. And that's a vital thing for any person, particularly a young person in this age. I'm sounding very curmudgeonly now, but I mean the romantic age beginning around 1810, not this age now, when we are taught and have been taught for a very long time now, essentially, that one's feelings are a reliable guide to everything. You know, feeling is everything, as Goethe said. That's complete bullshit, frankly. It's not. The craft is everything. What you feel is not a reliable guide to what is actually going to work. And once you've learned that, which is a painful case, and in my case demanded a very big punch straight on the nose from the public, then you can begin to say that, as you say, that step back to realise that this thing is only going to work if it works for other people. And that means you've got to understand how it works, the mechanisms, the craft, the you know, architecture and so forth, which can be taught, which can be learned.
Wow. Yeah, that's I was wondering whether to bring up the Russian film. So I'm glad that you did. I mean, partly because you're career is so sort of glittering and successful and brilliant. And I love this, the book that I've just been reading, The Shortest History of England.
Thank you.
I'm so enjoying it. I can't recommend it enough to other people. I suppose it would be easy in that line to just brush under the carpet things which have not gone quite so well. But it's really great for people. It's great for students, isn't it, to hear this is, never mind, here's somebody talking about all their successes. Here's someone talking about something which really didn't go well. And, you know, that was not the end of the world.
I've always begin my teaching, whether at Oxford University or Oxford Brookes, by sitting my students down and saying, you know, you do have a right. You should never forget, as students, you have the right to ask, you know, by what right does this person stand before me, ex cathedra and all that. And my right is that I've made the mistakes and can teach you not to make them. Provided always you can get through it and pick yourself up. Mistakes are, of course, the finest education on God's earth. So I don't regret those at all. Though at the time, I can't disguise the video, it was extraordinarily painful at the time, obviously.
I can imagine, yeah, I can imagine. It's great for our students, I think, to hear this, not least because our brilliant students often come to us not having put a foot wrong. That's how they get to us. You know, they've got these wonderful academic records. They've been sparkling in extracurricular activities. They are lovely, competent, engaged, creative people. And that is all, you know, that all ought to be good. But I think it can sometimes make the idea that you would fail at something or something would not go well seem catastrophic, unthinkably catastrophic. And it's just really great to be reminded that's just not the case. That's absolutely not the case. And I wondered, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was how it was, so you range in this book from the Romans up to the present day. It's an absolutely brilliant sweep. And what I so admire about it is the way you cut through and make a shape out of that. That's back, I think, to what you were saying about storytelling without being completely bogged down by particularities. And there's this brilliant running gag almost that I found so revelatory about the factors that have made the southeast of England the kind of privileged centre and the kind of ruling heartlands of England, and how that still, you know, that still continues. That seemed to me to be as much about sort of HS2 as it was about the Roman roads and so on. But I wondered how it was to write with that sort of clarity and unclogged vision about the very recent past or almost the present. How did you get to that?
Well, again, that's an enormous amount of input from my publisher, who's an editor himself, and his hired editor, the wonderful Matt Baylis, who wrote that lovely book about the island where they worship Prince Charles, the Duke of Edinburgh, rather. We worked very hard, and I say we worked very hard on that last sort of 30 pages to make sure that it still maintained that sense of a sort of Olympian distance from things while not ducking issues. I'm delighted you think it came off, because that was, you know, by far the hardest bit to get right, I think. Because one is, when one's starting to write about events in one's own lifetime, then it's very, very hard to not be partisan. But you have to not allow yourself to do that, at least not too visibly.
And what do you think is the historian's sort of narrative obligation to those resonances between past and present? I mean, one of the things I enjoyed about this book was descriptions of, you know, apparently the far past, which seemed and sort of dryly, I mean, dry as in wittily rather than as in boringly, wittily pointed towards something much more recent. That past present, you know, that seems a big discussion in historical writing at the moment, doesn't it? Is the past ever the past? You know, is it always the present in sort of doublet and hose, as I would see it?
I'm as you'll probably have detected, I'm a firm believer. I think we underestimate the pastness of the present. To sort of almost paraphrase William Faulkner. there are so many things which go on, which we fondly believe are new, are original. But when you start looking at, with open eyes at history, you see, and I'm paraphrasing Indiana Jones, you know, we are merely passing through history, that our lives are very short and they are much more contingent than particularly young people like to think. For example, I'm sitting here talking to you in Bath. You know, I can go 50 yards down the road here and talk to one of my neighbours with you here, who is essentially speaking Anglo-Saxon. He still uses the word to mean he, which is German. You know, that was outdated by Chaucer's day, well before Chaucer's day. Be going to market, that sort of thing. I think that's an illustration of the way. And if our very speech patterns seem to be almost time-proof in that way, I suspect that also our patterns of political and social thinking are actually far more contingent on the past than we believe. Which is why and I must stress this, when I'm writing this book, Emma, you know, I wrote, when I first began this book, if you'd asked me when did the North-South divide become important in England and in Britain and England particularly, I would probably have said Margaret Thatcher and deindustrialization of the North. If you had asked me when did the Normans start speaking English as their day language, I would probably have said, well, I don't know, probably about 1200. You know, I'd have been completely wrong on both counts, of course.
Just on that, right at the beginning of your book, there's an amazing map on page 5, which gives a division of England from the sort of Humber to the Severn, and marks it as the geological Jurassic divide, but also the limits of coin minting tribes, which I just thought in itself is just so fascinating. So the graphics in this book, as part of what you said about collaboration, are really, really wonderful. They really add a lot to that pithy sort of summary of how things work. But I just thought that could be a map of all kinds of things, you know, median income, sort of commuting distance, and all kinds of factors in the present day. It felt as if that line still exists.
I mean, really, as I say, I knew nothing about this when I started. My technique is, it's a very time-consuming one, I have to say, is that I download literally thousands, of JSTOR articles and things. I read through them for a year and a half or 2 years, then I start writing the book. The German poet Goethe had this theory which he called Anschauung, which I suppose we could try. We would say something like, in a Kantian sense, looking at things without any angle. Just quietly looking at things, and trying to let the story kind of show itself, and that sounds very highfalutin, but it isn't really. It's just so moments then come up when you've got your documents literally spread out over your floor before you, and as you say, if you can have that widespread and you read the map which you described there, say the Venerable Bede describing the North-South divide in 731, and then you come across a map by Danny Dorling, the Oxford Professor of Social Geography, right now. In 2007, about social differences in England, and it's the same line. You know, you can't help but feel the screen just coming in your head and think, what on earth is going on here?
Yes,
there must be something in this, and that's when it gets so exciting. And then, when you then trace it, and other things come, you don't realize. I had no idea that both Oxford and Cambridge formally divided their student bodies into Southerners and Northerners along the Trent, of course. In the 14th century.
That's amazing. It also made me understand a bit more just how much of a favourite of King Lear Cordelia, the youngest daughter, is, because that's the bit she's going to get.
Of course, I'd never thought of that.
Which and the sort of clarity of that made me think, no wonder your sisters hate you, goody two-shoes.
I had never thought about that. How lovely. God damn it, I'm just going in the next edition, Emma. That's fantastic. I did some stuff at the Playhouse in Oxford, and I wanted to be a professional actor for a while. And I once did a rep performance of Hotspur in Henry IV, despite which, you know, knowing what Henry IV is all about, part one, it had never occurred to me that there's this thing called the tripartite, how extraordinary this tripartite indenture really is in history. You know, this is the very moment when the kind of French-speaking unity of the English elite after the conquest is just crumbling. Suddenly, here are the Percys and the Mortimers
planning in cahoots with Owen Duerter to split England up forever. And then the tripartite indenture, a formal Latin document signed by the King of France himself, says it's going to be for each man and his successors forever. This is a permanent, they're planning to permanently divide England into northern and southern kingdoms. And that has slipped my mind, despite actually having been Hotspur for a couple of weeks. You know, so it's amazing when one rediscovers the excitement of these sort of insights. There were days when I had to say to my wife, you know, I understand why in cartoons they have a light bulb on people's heads when they have an idea, because I just feel that my head is full of light right now, you know.
Well, and absolutely, that's the experience of reading that book. It's been an absolute delight to read it over the last few days, and I really do. I can't recommend it highly enough. James, we're probably coming to the end of our conversation, but I wanted to just ask you something else about Hartford. I wanted to round off with that. So partly the prompt for this series of literary podcasts was to celebrate and investigate the great range of Hartford writers. And to do that, perhaps to focus our minds a bit on the library in Hartford. We've got big plans for an extension to the library that I hope very much we'll be able to prosecute over the next few years. But I wondered about you and Hartford Library. Was that a haunt of yours? Do you have fond memories of it?
It was a haunt. I have to confess, it was a haunt in a slightly bad way. The then dean, Dr. Tanner, saw me on top of the roof playing the French horn one day, and without a pause in his step, just looked up and said, "Ah, Mr. Hawes, I believe the fine is £10," and passed on his way in his gown. I was actually playing the French horn to celebrate a friend of mine coming back through the doors into the main quad, having just finished his PPE exams. But this is a secret which students might like to know. I used to practice my French horn in the chapel, which, as you know, has a fantastic acoustic, very forgiving for those who tend to split notes on the French horn. But I discovered that I was also accidentally given a key to the organ loft, from which you can emerge onto the roof of the library.
Do not try this at home, gentle listeners. But a sort of tarantara on the French horn would be a much preferable celebration of the end of finals than the current vogue for shaving foam and glitter, which is the bit that makes me like a sort of old. Fogey. I'm very much against this. That really is an invented tradition. Not in our day, I think. Was that an Oxford thing?
I mean, I have to confess, I didn't use the library that much, simply because, and this is something which I think is tremendously special at Harvard, because I did most of my finals work in Duke Humphrey, which is just such a wonderful experience. And that is what's so special at Harvard, is you, because, I mean, even if you're walking from, say, Christchurch, where my son was, up into the main centre, you know, you're passing takeaways and coffee shops and things, but you walk out of the main quad in Hartford, you can walk down New College Lane under the bridge, or you can walk around the Radcliffe Common, and there is no sign of commercialism. There's no sign of the 20th century essentially around you. There are no neon and no special offers. And you can, and that, just that experience of walking out of the old quad and across to the Bod and into Duke Humphrey, I found it just a wonderful bath of being able to escape from the modern world when I really had to for my finals, you know. And I think the centrality of Hartford is something which, again, people underestimate. What a small but definite difference that makes to your experience of being in Oxford, actually being in the centre of things. And even the walk from Magdalen or Christchurch, never mind from the former women's colleges, you're having to sort of get into Oxford, whereas Hartford, you walk through the door and you're there straight away. And somehow that's a subtle but, I found, important difference.
I hadn't thought, I mean, like everybody, I've been far away from my workplace, if not geographically, then somehow mentally over lockdown. I hadn't thought quite so clearly how slipping out of the door in Hartford, going either across into the main quad of the Bodleian or into Radcliffe Square, you are really in a cityscape which is centuries old. I suppose that perhaps makes it clear why New College was so against the Bridge of Sighs. You know, when we had the bridge's birthday, 100th birthday, Some of the opposition from New College was read out to the bridge being built. And it was going to be a great eyesore, and nobody would ever want to look at it. And actually, it's Jackson's, the architect's, great triumph, I think, that it fits so well into that rather timeless feeling space.
Yes, I mean, I think Hartford should be charging the university every time the university uses it as its kind of de facto logo, which it does sometimes.
Yes, we have wondered about that, and I also became very fascinated by those Christo sort of sculptures and happenings. You know, where they wrap.
Oh yes, he wrapped the rice bag,
the marble arch or something. I thought we should have had it wrapped up, which would be wonderful. James, this has been such a great conversation. Thank you for your generosity in being part of our literary podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And so thanks also to Hannah Baronzo, who has done all the work producing this. But particularly thanks to you, James Hawes, for being our guest today.
It's been a huge pleasure.
The next podcast is moving to quite a different part of Hartford's literary output. And I'm going to be talking with Anya Glazer about her illustrated books for children. So if you might be in the market for a book for 4 or 5 or 6 year olds, or to think more about books for children and how they should be, do listen in next time. Thanks very much.